Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 63, special COVID-19 edition, number 11, but who's counting? I'm hoping to reopen the show to non-COVID-19 news and research, but again, COVID-19 continues this week to be the overwhelmingly most important public health issue. It's Friday, May 22nd. I am coming to you from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, which still looks eerily like my den as I shelter in place. I am hoping you are staying safe, protecting yourself and others. First up, snake oil salesman in chief Donald Trump announced his use of hydrochloroquine this week, not even as a treatment for infection, but apparently as an attempt to prevent infection. And hydrochloroquine sales skyrocket. Of course, hydroxychloroquine is an effective drug for preventing malaria, and I will go out on a limb here and make a bold prediction. I predict that Donald Trump will not get malaria. Well, will he get COVID-19? That's a different matter. I guess, like the chief medical officer of America likes to say, we'll have to wait and see.
And now a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you, your friends and loved ones, your city, state, your entire nation, suffer from an unprecedented crisis? Then your body politic may be infected with TLTL-2020 virus, also known as the TL-20 squared virus. This too little too late 2020 virus has many vague and contradicting symptoms, but it is known to be exacerbated by election years. Do you suffer from exponential anxiety, worldwide depression, and recurring hallucinations of unimpeachable leadership? Don't worry, as the 2020 campaign season heats up, this will all go away. We don't call it a novelty virus for nothing. Hey people, don't look down. Things are looking up. Body bag futures are looking fantastic. This promises to be the best pandemic ever. Incredible things will happen as you save the world by doing nothing but watching TV. But remember, only get your Nothing Burgers from the drive-through window. Please note, Nothing Burgers will now be referred to as Patriot Burgers. Doing too little has never been easier. Hey, what's the worst? That could happen. This message is brought to you by Cassandra Reproductions, seer of unbelievable futures, and maker of Pickled Posterity, coming too little, too late, to a shuttered store near you. You may now return to your regular programming.
Okay, well, let's continue with our national news. This from the Associated Press. Trump lashes out at scientists whose findings contradict him. A Trump enemy statement, he said, of one study. A political hit job, he said, of another. As President Donald Trump pushes to reopen the country despite warnings from doctors about the consequences of moving too quickly during the coronavirus crisis, he has been lashing out at scientists whose conclusions he doesn't like. Twice this week, Trump has not only dismissed the findings of studies, but suggested, without evidence, that their authors were motivated by politics and out to undermine his efforts to roll back coronavirus restrictions. First, it was a study funded in part by his own government's National Institutes of Health that raised alarms about the use of hydroxychloroquine, finding a higher overall mortality in coronavirus patients who took the drug while in Veterans Administration hospitals. Trump and many of his allies had been touting the drug as a miracle cure, and Trump this week revealed that he has been taking it to try to ward off the virus, despite an FDA warning last month that it should only be used in hospital settings or clinical trials because of the risk of serious side effects, including life-threatening heart problems. Of course, you have to have a heart to have heart problems, I suppose. Okay. The Lancet, one of the world's oldest and most well-respected journals, published a new study that echoed those findings. He offered similar pushback Thursday to a new study from Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. It found that more than 61% of COVID-19 infections and 55% of reported deaths, nearly 36,000 people, could have been prevented had social distancing measures been put in place 1 week sooner. Trump has repeatedly defended his administration's handling of the virus in face of persistent criticism that he acted too slowly. Trump told reporters, "Columbia is an institution that's very liberal. I think it's just a political hit job. You want to know the truth." Trump has long been skeptical of mainstream science, dismissing human-made climate change as a hoax, suggesting that noise from wind turbines causes cancer, and claiming that exercise can deplete a body's finite amount of energy. It's part of a larger skepticism of expertise and backlash against so-called elites that has become increasingly popular among Trump's conservative base. But undermining Americans' trust in the integrity and objectivity of scientists is especially dangerous during a pandemic when the public is relying on its leaders to develop policies based on the best available information, said Larry Gostin, a Georgetown University law professor who's an expert in public health. "We have every right to expect that our leaders will use the best science to keep us safe and protect us," Gostin said. "And so the idea that you reject objective scientific information that could inform policies that have life or death consequences is unfathomable." Asked this week what evidence he had that the drug was effective in preventing COVID-19, contrary to FDA guidance, Trump responded, "Are you ready? Here's my evidence. I got a lot of positive calls about it. The only negative I've heard," he added, "was the study where they gave it. Was it the VA? With, you know, people that aren't big Trump fans." Next up, from CNBC, Fauci says it's still possible that a coronavirus vaccine will be available in the U.S. by December. It is, quote, conceivable the U.S. could begin to roll out a coronavirus vaccine by December, the White House's top infectious disease expert said. Dr. Anthony Fauci added that any timeline for a vaccine is, quote, never a promise. Quote, "When you're dealing with vaccines, there could be so many things that get in the way, like it might not be entirely effective." Conceivable? Perhaps. Likely? About as likely as Trump and Fauci unveiling their love child. Next up from CNN. "We've been muzzled," CDC sources say, White House putting politics ahead of science. In the early weeks of the U.S. coronavirus outbreak, staff members in the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention had tracked a growing number of transmissions in Europe and elsewhere and proposed a global advisory that would alert flyers to the dangers of air travel. But about a week passed before the alert was issued publicly. Crucial time lost when about 66,000 European travelers were streaming into American airports every day. The delay, detailed in documents obtained by CNN, is the latest example to emerge of a growing sense of disconnect between the CDC and the White House. In interviews with CNN, CDC officials say their agency's efforts to mount a coordinated response to the COVID-19 pandemic have been hamstrung by a White House whose decisions are driven by politics rather than science. The result has worsened the effects of the crisis, sources inside the CDC say, relegating the 73-year-old agency that has traditionally led the nation's response to infectious disease to a supporting role. Rising tensions between CDC leadership and the White House over the perception that the agency has been sidelined has been a developing story in the media for weeks. But now, mid- and higher-ranking staff members within the agency six of whom spoke with CNN for this story, are starting to voice their discontent. Those six spoke on condition of anonymity for fear of reprisals. "We've been muzzled," said a current CDC official. "What's tough is that if we would have acted earlier on what we knew and recommended, we would have saved lives and money." Sources say the origin of the trust issues between the CDC and the White House traces back to the CDC's botched effort to distribute testing in early February, when contamination in the lab led to long delays. Relations between them soured further in late February, when high-ranking CDC official Nancy Messonnier warned the American public at a time when President Donald Trump was out of the country and downplaying the threat that, quote, "the disruption to everyday life might be severe. The consequences have filtered down to the American public in tangible ways. One that caused consternation within the agency involved the delayed travel alert in early March. As COVID-19 was racing across the globe, a March 2nd CDC internal daily report attributed spread in the European region to Italy, but also noted evidence of local transmission in 29 other countries. In a follow-up report 2 days later, 85 international locations had reported cases. On March 5th, with three of the top six countries outside of China affected by the disease in Europe, the CDC was expecting to post a global travel alert that night, according to a CDC document that noted the alert had been cleared internally. Although the CDC had already posted some travel warnings for individual countries, such as China, Italy, Iran, and South Korea, the proposed alert would have urged precautions for international travel anywhere. But it didn't happen that night. For unexplained reasons, the travel alert that was expected to be posted March 5th didn't occur until March 11th, the same day Trump announced his sharp restrictions on travel from more than two dozen European countries. Asked about the time lapse, a Trump administration official said the CDC had issued warnings and alerts by early March for specific countries dealing with the outbreaks. The administration officials also said the CDC is one of many agencies that is part of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, and that the views of the CDCs have always been represented at task force meetings and folded into what has been presented as White House briefings on the press briefings on the virus. CDC did not respond to multiple requests for comment on the travel advisory issue or the wider allegation that the CDC has been sidelined. A senior official inside the CDC told CNN that the agency also alerted the White House to the virus's rapid spread across Europe, but that the White House was extremely focused on China and not wanting to anger Europe, even though that's where most of our cases were originally coming from. Some experts say the worst consequences of the frayed relationship is a general sense that the CDC has lost its place as the face and voice of public health in the midst of a 100-year pandemic. The CDC were part of the mistakes with the early problems with testing, and it seemed like after that they weren't trusted as much, said James Curran, dean of the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University and a former CDC official. But he added, "There's no place in the world that has more epidemiologists and scientists studying respiratory infections. We need them now." During the swine flu pandemic in 2009, Dr. Ann Schuschat, then the CDC's director of the National Center of Immunization and Respiratory Diseases, she's now the principal deputy director, was a constant presence in the media. So much so that she became the inspiration for Kate Winslet's character in the movie Contagion. During the Ebola crisis of 2014, then CDC head Tom Ferdinand took command of the public spotlight, heading up press conferences to deliver the latest news and often serving as the voice of the federal government's response in media interviews. Although the current CDC leader, Dr. Robert Redfield, participates in the White House briefings, experts say his presence has been subdued in comparison to his predecessors. The public face of the COVID-19 crisis has instead been ceded to Dr. Anthony Fauci, the head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, and Deborah Birx, coordinator for the President's Coronavirus Task Force. "I respect and admire Dr. Fauci immensely, but he represents the scientific and research lane, and Dr. Birx represents the policy lane at the White House level," said Dr. Howard Markle, a public health and medicine historian at the University of Michigan. "The CDC represents the public health lane, internationally, as well as working with state and territorial health offices, so I would want a representative from that lane." In the initial days of the outbreak in China, the CDC was out in front on public messaging. It hosted a teleconference call with reporters about the new coronavirus on January 17th, not even a week after China had reported its first death. "This is a serious situation," said Messonnier, director of the CDC's National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases. "It's crucial to be proactive and prepared." But then came Messonnier's grim warning on February 25th. The following day, Trump installed Vice President Mike Pence as the head of the White House Coronavirus Task Force. Within a couple weeks, the telebriefings tapered off. Then it got really dicey because obviously it became hyper-political, said a current CDC staffer. Earlier this month, CNN reported that the Trump administration shelved CDC-drafted guidelines to reopen the U.S. The CDC's guidelines were more strict and detailed than the White House's own roadmap toward a return to normal. If you look at our guidance documents alone, they have been watered down a lot, said a current CDC official. The ones that were written in March say, go home and stay there, and they are very clear. And the ones now say, in consultation with state and local governors, do what they say. The official added, we normally give guidance and then states take that guidance and turn it into policy. A CDC employee said an overarching concern is that the agency's scientific work is taking a backseat to politics. The message we received in previous administrations was, you guys are the scientists, the employee said. That's not the case this time. If the science that we are offering up contradicts a specific policy goal, then we are the problem. Sticking to this theme, also from CNN, in an article entitled, CDC estimates that 35% of coronavirus patients don't have symptoms, but more importantly, it talks about a larger project going on. The numbers are part of five planning scenarios that are being used by mathematical modelers throughout the federal government, according to the CDC. Four of these scenarios represent the lower and upper bounds of disease severity and viral transmissibility. Under the most severe of the five scenarios outlined, not the agency's best estimate, the CDC lists symptomatic case fatality ratio of 0.01, meaning that 1% of people overall with COVID-19 and symptoms would die. In the least severe scenario, the CDC puts that number at 0.2%. One expert quickly pushed back on the CDC's estimates. While most of these numbers are reasonable, the mortality rates shade far too low, biologist Carl Bergstrom of the University of Washington told CNN. Bergstrom, an expert in modeling and computer simulations, said the numbers seem inconsistent with real-world findings. Estimates of the numbers infected in places like New York City are way out of line with these estimates. Let us remember that the number of deaths in New York City right now are far more than what we would expect if every adult and child in the city had been infected with a flu-like virus. This is not the flu, it's COVID, Bergstrom said. As I see it, the best estimate is extremely optimistic, and the worst-case scenario is fairly optimistic even as a best estimate. One certainly wants to consider worst-case scenarios, Bergstrom said of CDC's numbers. By introducing these as the official parameter sets for modeling efforts, CDC is influencing the models produced by federal agencies, but also the broader scientific discourse, because there will be some pressure to use the CDC standard parameter sets in modeling papers going forward, he said. Given that these parameter sets underestimate fatality by a substantial margin compared to current scientific consensus, this is deeply problematic. Deeply problematic. Well, I think that these five new, quote, planning scenarios may very well be the official point that historians will note as the deep sixing of the CDC during this pandemic response, or non-response as the case may be. First, these planning scenarios look to really be coming from the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, which is not part of the CDC. I strongly suspect that this non-CDC office is serving as the political arm of the Trump regime, the cronies that are charged with twisting data to their political whims. CDC typically offers well-referenced documents, giving scientific citations to back up their conclusions. These planning scenarios have a grand total of, wait for it, three references. Maybe not even that. First up, their first reference is an article entitled Epidemiological Characteristics of COVID-19, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. This looked at 57 studies published through March 11th, 2020. This is a perfectly legitimate citation, if not a little dated given this fast-moving pandemic and a flurry of research. The second is from 2014, entitled Influenza-Like Illness, The Time to Seek Healthcare and Influenza Antiviral Receipt During the 2010-2011 Influenza Season. Okay, first of all, it's not even a reference to COVID-19 specifically. And if you're trying to compare flu to COVID-19 flu-like symptoms, remember, people have been told from the beginning to this day that if you have flu-like symptoms, do not go to healthcare as you normally would. Do you think that people may not be seeking COVID-19 healthcare the same as the flu? And three, which isn't really a reference, the rest is cited as internal data from U.S. cases through March 31st. Again, actually not that deep into the epidemic. Normally, such publications like this might appear in the Distinguished Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, or the MMWR, which is the major weekly scientific publication from CDC, perhaps with a methodology given to offer scientific transparency and professional review. Nope, did not happen. So, what does this actually mean? From the webpage revealing these, quote, planning scenarios, quote, the planning scenarios are being used by mathematical modelers throughout the federal government. The planning scenarios may also be useful to hospital administrators in assessing resource needs and can be used in conjunction with the COVID-19 surge tool, end of quote. Now, this COVID-19 surge tool is one that hospital administrators and public health officials can use to estimate the surge in demand for hospital-based services during the COVID-19 pandemic, which can produce estimates of the number of COVID-19 patients that need to be hospitalized, the number requiring intensive care, unit care, and the number requiring ventilator support. This could directly affect decisions to pull back from reopening. Rosier data in such a model could prolong so-called data-driven decisions to put the brakes on re-emerging hotspots. If the numbers don't support opening, oops, too late for that. That is, if the numbers raise the nasty question of slamming the brakes on reopening as community-wide outbreaks re-emerge, well, then just change the numbers to lower the bar of how much of an outbreak might warrant tightening rather than loosening restrictions. Looks like we just got delivered another truckload from the Strategic National Stockpile, a truckload of cynical manipulation. Okay, well, as we're reopening, let's look at this story from the Washington Post. Thousands from coronavirus hotspots flocked to Maryland and Virginia as parts of the states reopened. Nearly 860,000 additional travelers flocked to parts of Maryland and Virginia over the weekend as states began to reopen, according to researchers tracking smartphone data. Many were from the Washington suburbs, which remained shut down because of their significantly higher coronavirus caseloads, the data shows. The 18% jump in travel from previous weekends brought a total 5.83 million trips to those areas between Friday and Sunday, according to an analysis by University of Maryland researchers. Virginia Governor Ralph Northam, Democrat, and Maryland Governor Larry Hogan, Republican, lifted shutdown orders on some businesses Friday, but allowed the hard-hit Washington region to remain closed at the request of local leaders. The increase in travel, including from coronavirus hotspots, underscores concerns among public health experts that piecemeal lifting of restrictions increases the chances of the virus spreading. They say they're particularly concerned about rural areas, where there have been fewer cases, as people travel from closed areas to those that have reopened. It's a really bad scenario, said Li Zhang, lead researcher on the University of Maryland project. By reopening some parts of states considered at low risk ahead of coronavirus hotspots, Zhang said, it actively encourages people to travel from high-risk areas to these otherwise safer, more rural areas without many cases. That's certainly not a good trend. Zhang, director of the Maryland Transportation Institute, said stepped-up travel in the Delmarva region matches national trends. Nationwide, about 47 million people crossed state lines Friday. That was more than twice as many as in mid-April, and climbing back toward the pre-pandemic daily average of 55 million, even as government officials in many parts of the country continue to ask residents to stay home as much as possible to slow the virus's spread. How quickly these out-of-state trips are coming back is really shocking, he said. Maryland and Virginia's reopenings coincide with a sunny, warm weekend. There are reports of throngs of people on the Ocean City boardwalk, with many not wearing masks or practicing social distancing. Recreational trails also attracted crowds of cyclists and hikers. Ocean City Mayor Rick Meehan said he was concerned about visitors bringing the virus from places that remained under stay-at-home orders. They're in place for a reason, Meehan said. We've never encouraged people to violate those orders. If people are in a hot spot, they shouldn't be traveling. They should be following those orders. Zhang said researchers estimate that 40% of the new weekend trips in Maryland and Virginia were related to business reopening. The other 60%, he said, followed trends seen over the past several weeks attributed to, quote, quarantine fatigue, as people sick of mostly staying home have begun to venture out. He noted that many of the Maryland businesses allowed to reopen weren't the kind that attract weekend visitors. Travelers to Ocean City, for example, still had to line up outside restaurants for takeout. I think people just want to be outdoors in places that don't feel like home, Zhang said. Louisa Franzini, chair of the Health Policy and Management Department at the University of Maryland School of Public Health, said she also suspects much of the travel stems from a growing restlessness rather than a desire to frequent newly opened businesses. The parts of Maryland that began to reopen saw the biggest increase, nearly 570,000 new weekend visitors, probably because it's closer to population-rich states such as Pennsylvania and New Jersey. About 40% of new travelers to reopen parts of Maryland came from Washington suburbs that remain shut down, Zhang said. About 7% came from the district, where most non-essential businesses remain closed. About 47% came from other states, including Pennsylvania, Delaware, and West Virginia. About one-third of the travelers to Virginia came from areas of the state still shut down, while most of the other two-thirds came from states other than Maryland, according to the data. We need a lot more clarity about what shutdowns mean for people still under lockdown, she said. If that clarity is not going to come, then I think we need to revisit the wisdom of reopening piecemeal. And on that same theme from NBC News, Americans are moving again. See how driving, walking, and transit are returning to normal. Americans are moving again, or at least they're looking for directions again. Apple began publishing data in April showing the change in searches for directions in Apple Maps in about 70 U.S. cities. And while the data showed clear drop-offs in requests for transit, walking, and driving directions in March, search volume has moved back to pre-coronavirus levels in 7 cities. Walking directions are above where they were in late January in Toledo, Ohio, Omaha, Nebraska, Corpus Christi, Texas, Virginia Beach, Virginia, Bakersfield, California, Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Memphis, Tennessee. Driving directions also rebounded in several of those cities, with Omaha, Corpus Christi, Memphis, and good old Toledo all back above pre-coronavirus levels.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me. But the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, with Corey the Coronavirus still hanging out there, this from CNN. Coronavirus testing is, quote, a mess, in the U.S. report says. Coronavirus testing in the United States is disorganized and needs coordination at the national level, infectious disease experts said in a new report. Right now, testing is not accurate enough to use alone to make most decisions, including who should go back to work or to school, the team at the University of Minnesota said. It's a mess out there, Mike Osterholm, head of the University Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy, which issued the report. Testing is very, very important, but we're not doing the right testing. The number of tests that have been completed, numbers widely reported by states and by the White House, show only part of the picture, the report reads. Some states have combined diagnostic and antibody test results, skewing their data. The data is really kind of screwed up, Osterholm said. It's because the public health system is overwhelmed. The report has some specific recommendations for diagnostic tests that check to see if someone is currently infected with the coronavirus. Testing is most useful for clinical care of patients, for disease surveillance and contact tracing, and for monitoring frontline workers such as emergency responders, doctors, and nurses who may have been exposed. People with symptoms should also be tested, it says. But coronavirus testing is not accurate enough yet to use in many other ways. It recommends against universal testing in hospital settings, testing in schools or other low-risk settings, widespread community-based testing, antibody tests to decide who goes back to work, and immunity passports, so-called immunity passports. It might be useful to test asymptomatic people in long-term care facilities in some cases because they are likely to have many cases, the report said. Asymptomatic shedding of the virus may be detected with a molecular test, which looks for the virus itself, or an antigen test, which looks for an immune response to the virus. It is not yet clear where, when, and how asymptomatic individuals should be tested. The report also says that antibody tests should be used only with caution. These tests check for the blood for evidence of an immune response to the virus and indicate that someone has been infected for some days or has even cleared an infection. They are most useful for identifying donors of plasma used to treat patients or for deciding on how to manage patients when standard diagnostic tests are negative. It's not clear if antibody tests are useful for testing of healthcare workers to determine immune status, according to the report. We believe that greatly expanding SARS-CoV-2 testing is a critical element in a response to COVID-19, the report reads. For testing to be maximally effective, coordination across the system and across jurisdictions is necessary. Ideally, this requires federal guidance, leadership, and support, with strong jurisdictional buy-in at the state and local level. The report calls on the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services to appoint a panel to oversee and organize testing. The panel should include representatives from public health, clinical laboratory, and medicine. The laboratory testing, research and development, marketing and product support industries, ethicists, legal scholars, and elected officials, it says. Osterholm noted that some states are combining data from diagnostic tests and antibody tests to make estimates about how many people have been infected. The Food and Drug Administration advises against using tests in this way, and so does Osterholm. You need to do the right test at the right time to get the right result. He said nobody is thinking through that. Plus, there's not enough coordination to ensure that states have the testing supplies they need. This is a system, and if a system breaks down anywhere, it breaks down everywhere. What good are test results if you can't trust them? And this from the Hill. Navajo Nation under strict lockdown with highest coronavirus infection rate in the country. The Navajo Nation has passed New York for the highest coronavirus infection rate per capita in the country. It is reporting more than 2,000 COVID cases per 100,000 people. Residents are under one of the strictest lockdown orders in the country. The territory has implemented strict preventive measures, including mandating face masks in public, closing even essential businesses, and implementing a 57-hour lockdown on weekends. The Native American community had braced for the potentially disastrous effects of the coronavirus pandemic in their community as early as February. Still, with only 5 hospitals under the Navajo Area Indian Health Service and limited access to vital resources, the community has been overwhelmed. 2 teams from Doctors Without Borders arrived in April to aid local health services with their response. And if after that you still think we got this epidemic under control, this from the Washington Post. Mask shortage for most healthcare workers extended into May, post-Ipsos poll shows. Frontline healthcare workers still experience shortages of critical equipment needed for protection from the coronavirus into early May, including nearly two-thirds who cited insufficient supplies of the face mask to filter out most airborne particles. More than 4 in 10 also saw shortages of less protective surgical masks, and 36% said their supply of hand sanitizer was running low, according to the poll. Roughly 8 in 10 reported wearing one mask for an entire shift, and more than 7 in 10 had to wear the same mask more than once. The survey showed that more than 7 in 10 healthcare workers expressed concern about exposing members of their household to the virus after coming in contact with it at work, and roughly half were regularly changing out of clothing before entering their homes. About a third said someone at their workplace has been infected with the coronavirus. A 58% majority said it was likely they had been exposed at work. Just over 1 in 10, or 12%, of healthcare workers said they do not have health insurance themselves. More than 6 in 10 have paid sick leave, though over 3 in 10 do not, and the rest were not even sure. And the final financial outlook for many is shaky. Nearly half of healthcare workers, 48%, were at least somewhat concerned about paying their bills. Okay, well, with that, let's turn to the local situation. We're holding relatively steady relative to Ohio and the nation as far as our case rate and our death rate. Not good, but holding steady relative to those entities. Lucas County hospitalizations are trending up in the last 2 weeks, while hospitalizations statewide are trending down, except for the two most recent days where there has been an increase statewide. Ohio ranked 44th among states in social distancing. Lucas County has moved down from 7th to 8th, that is last, among Ohio metropolitan counties in social distancing. Our encounter density is peaking back up over the time just before school closures and major sports cancellations. That is not good news. Ohio ranked 44th among states in tests per capita, and this is actually represents us falling farther behind relative to the vast majority of other states. Okay, what about the continually unfolding tragedy of nursing homes? This from Dayton Daily News. Ohio National Guard to lead nursing home coronavirus testing. State leaders say Ohio National Guard will be leading more proactive testing for nursing home residents and workers, as early data indicates 70% of Ohioans who have died from COVID-19 were nursing home and assisted living residents. Industry leaders have advocated from the early days of the pandemic to have mass testing of those at long-term care facilities, which can be the only way an infectious worker without symptoms knows the risk they pose to residents. However, such testing takes funding, testing supplies, and coordination. The details of how this will be paid for and coordinated is still not clear. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine said that the Ohio National Guard units will be going to nursing homes to collect specimens to test for the coronavirus. We're going to push the testing as hard as we can in these nursing homes, and I think in the next 7 days we're going to be able to report to you a lot more progress in that area, DeWine said. As of last Wednesday afternoon, the state's preliminary mortality data reported 1,247 residents of Ohio's long-term care facilities to have died from the virus. Up until now, that total included deaths only after April 15th, which was when the state began tracking long-term care deaths by facility. The new 1,247 deaths includes the 878 deaths reported since April 15th and the 369 residents who died before mid-April, when Ohio recorded only whether an individual had been in a nursing home, according to updated health department statistics obtained by the Associated Press. That means even with aggressive visitor restrictions designed to curb infections, more than 60% of Ohio coronavirus deaths from COVID-19 have been in nursing homes among the residents, while less than 1% of Ohio residents live in nursing homes. People are at increased risk for the virus when living in congregated settings and also when they have multiple underlying conditions, and nursing homes involve both of those factors. The U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, which is the federal nursing home regulator, set out new guidelines on May 18th saying restrictions on nursing homes can relax and open to visitors if they have weekly testing of all nursing home residents and staff, though did not provide additional guidance on how to fund these tests. American Healthcare Association, a national trade group for nursing home owners, said if assuming $150 per test and assuming employment is similar to last count on May 2019, it would cost a little under $25 million for one round of testing of workers and residents, nursing home residents in Ohio. For the Ohio effort, it's not clear who will be processing the tests or how they are going to be paid for. A message was left with the state seeking more information. Catherine Broad, CEO of Leading Age Ohio, which represents nonprofit long-term care providers such as nursing homes, said their members have been asking for testing and more personal protective equipment since early on in the pandemic. So we've been grateful that the state has been moving forward on this, but I think that important thing to consider for congregate care facilities is that testing isn't just a one-step process, Broad said. There's the testing specimen collection. That is what the National Guard would be mobilized to do. But then there's also the testing processing. Who's going to process it? How quickly are we going to know test results? Who is going to pay for that? There's some pretty significant unknowns. There's then other challenges, such as what's the right approach if someone does test positive? In an assisted living facility, for example, Broad said, there might be infection control benefits to cohorting residents together on a unit, but that would mean moving people from their home, which is a different context than the way you can cohort infectious hospital patients to a specific unit in a hospital. You can't just switch Mrs. Smith and Mrs. Jones in their rooms because those rooms are their homes, Broad said. And to give an update on what the Lucas County status is with nursing homes, in the most recent week for which data is available, there were 196 residents who newly tested positive and 143 staff that tested newly positive. That's for a total of 339 new total positives in the most recent week. Of the 35 facilities who have ever reported a positive, 32 of those reported a new positive in the most recent week. Now, I haven't been able to get the number of total tests that have recently been conducted in long-term care facilities, nor have I been able to find out the proportion of long-term care testing at all in Lucas County, but I'm still trying to gather that data if, in fact, we have it. Okay. In more Ohio news from the Columbus Dispatch, lawsuit seeks release of 15,000-plus Ohio inmates amid coronavirus outbreak. A federal lawsuit alleging cruel and unusual punishment seeks the release of more than 15,000 inmates from an Ohio's coronavirus-afflicted state prison system. Four inmates filed the action in U.S. District Court in Columbus against Governor Mike DeWine and the Director of the Department of Rehabilitation and Correction, Annette Chambers-Smith. Unless medically vulnerable and other prisoners are released to reduce overcrowding and permit more social distancing, more inmates and employees will contract COVID-19, resulting in deaths, the lawsuit contends. The state failed to take meaningful action prior to COVID-19's silent creep into the prisons, but it's not too late to save lives and diminish the further spread, the lawsuit states. Without intervention from this court, the state will continue to act without urgency, which will result in the needless death of prisoners, staff, and members of the community at large. The lawsuit filed by the law firm of Joseph Patitus in Strongsville outside Cleveland seeks class action status to represent all of Ohio's 48,000 prison inmates on the claims of constitutional violations. Nearly one in five of Ohio's coronavirus cases stems from state prisons, with 4,498 inmates and 571 prison employees infected, according to state figures. The Pickaway and Marion Correctional Institutions were the hardest hit, with about 80% of inmates at each prison infected. State officials say that three-fourths of the system's infected inmates have recovered. 60 inmates have died, including 14 at Marion and 35 at Pickaway, which houses the prison equivalent of a nursing home for chronically ill and older inmates. A correction officer at Marion and a nurse at Pickaway also died from COVID-19. The lawsuit seeks a court order releasing prisoners who have one of many chronic health conditions and releasing all prisoners who are serving sentences for lower-level fourth and fifth degree felonies, including drug crimes. The average stay among all inmates is 2.7 years. The lawsuit also seeks the release of inmates older than 55 who have served at least two-thirds or 10 years of a sentence for first and second degree felonies. The action also seeks the release of convicted murderers and rapers over the age of 55 if they are deemed not dangerous and have served their minimum terms or at least 25 years in prison. The lawsuit states, the consequences of COVID-19's raid into the prison system could have been largely avoided had Governor DeWine and the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections acted with the same urgency and scope of restriction used for the state at large. Instead, thousands of prisoners have been left to languish in fear of the coming viral onslaught. A governor's office spokesman declined to comment on the lawsuit. The state has released hundreds of nonviolent inmates who were within 90 days of completing their sentences in a bid to lessen overcrowding and reduce the spread of the coronavirus. And in other news from Ohio, this also from the Columbus Dispatch, and this reaches beyond mere COVID-19 news. Franklin County, racism is a public health crisis. The declaration was a first of its kind for the agency, and health officials say it's more than just a statement of formal opinion. Rather, the declaration included a number of action steps to address racism and disparities within the agency and in how it provides services to residents. Franklin County Public Health formally declared racism a public health crisis this week and vowed to do something about it. The declaration was the first of its kind for the agency, and health officials say it's more than just the statement of a formal opinion. We thought it was important that, as a health department, we go on the record to make sure our community understands the connections and how our health is impacted, County Health Commissioner Joe Mazzola said. It's a significant document. Franklin County Public Health began developing the resolution months before the COVID-19 hit the scene, but the ongoing pandemic has further spotlighted health disparities among African American and other minority residents, including higher incidences of hypertension, diabetes, and other chronic health issues. The Dispatch reported This month, that black residents in Columbus and Franklin County continue to make up a disproportionate share of coronavirus infections and hospitalizations. For minorities, and especially for African Americans, there are huge disparities, said Assistant Health Commissioner Teresa Seagraves. It is unfortunate that here in Ohio, we are a state that has some of the best clinical and health services in the nation, but when it comes to healthcare outcomes, we are consistently rated at the bottom. The underlying reason for these really institutionalized and systemic poor health outcomes and disparities does link back to racism. The Public Health Crisis Declaration adopted by Franklin County Public Health noted that black Ohioans have a lower life expectancy, a higher likelihood of death by heart disease or stroke, and higher infant mortality rate, among other indicators. Among other actions, the declaration calls for increased efforts to educate the public about the effects of racism on public health and a review of ordinances and agency policies to ensure equity and diversity. Along those lines, the agency approved this week a $3,000 contract to provide training to employees on racism and equity in public health, and a separate resolution implementing a health and equity in all policies policy to further address related issues within the agency. We do mean for the agency to address all biases, all isms that are being demonstrated as we do our work, Seagraves said. We clearly spell out what the roles and responsibilities are for our employees, for supervisors, for senior staff, and even for our board members. Everybody has a role in this. Seagraves said the public health crisis declared this week was modeled after comparable declarations by cities and counties in other states. Franklin County is among the first in Ohio, with Cleveland also considering its own resolution. It's my hope that this also gains traction in other city and county health departments across the state, particularly those in large urban areas, and that as we gain traction in those locations, perhaps we could have some influence on the Ohio Department of Health to do something similar, said Dr. Arthur James, a member of the County Health Board. Franklin County Commissioners formally acknowledged the need to address racial disparities as part of its poverty eradicating plan, which was unveiled about a year ago. But all three commissioners said Thursday that they would support adopting a public health crisis resolution too. It is new to declare that racism is a nuisance to public health, Commissioner Kevin Boyce said. Commissioner Marilyn Brown added, the disparities have shown themselves in a much bigger way through this pandemic in every possible way. We knew they were there, but clearly through the pandemic, we've seen disparities in every possible way. Commissioner John O'Grady said racism is its own pandemic and one that's been around for all our lives. If a resolution by the county commissioners calling it what it is can help, then I'm all for it. Okay, well, we're getting to the end of the show. I want to do a few more stories here. Here's a more general one. This from 538. How bad is the COVID-19 misinformation epidemic? The COVID-19 pandemic has been equally defined by how much we don't know as much as we do. That vacuum has been quickly filled with bull hockey, I guess you can say on the radio. The United Nations Secretary General has warned we're living through a pandemic of misinformation, and the head of the World Health Organization said it's an infodemic. In the midst of battling a global health emergency, we find ourselves fending off another scourge of conspiracy theories and misinformation. It certainly feels like there's a lot of fake news swirling around about the coronavirus, but how does it compare to another major misinformation magnet, the 2016 election? Research on coronavirus misinformation is largely limited to public opinion surveys and preprint research that has yet to be peer-reviewed. But when we compare those preliminary findings to research on the 2016 election, they suggest that more people are seeing and believing misinformation now, and it may have something to do with the challenge of understanding a new disease. Measuring exactly how much bunk is out there to begin with is a challenge, in part because so much information is shared through social media, said Gordon Pennycook, a behavioral psychologist at Canada's University of Regina, who studies fake news. It's possible to measure, for instance, the number of tweets linking to specific fake news websites, but no way to see every instance a particular false claim is made on Facebook, especially when those claims can take many forms, including memes, Pennycook said. An easier measure is how many people recall having seen fake news. A Pew Research Center survey conducted in the second week of March found that 48% of Americans reported seeing at least some made-up news about the outbreak. Only 20% of respondents said they had seen no fake news. The remaining 32% said they had seen, quote, not much. In a preprint paper from researchers at Cornell University, respondents were simply asked if they remember seeing certain claims about a coronavirus, some of which were true and some of which are false. About 7% of respondents accurately recalled seeing a false claim. But just because you've seen fake news doesn't mean you believe it. I've seen plenty of bogus claims in my Facebook timeline myself, and I haven't started drinking bleach yet. So far, research indicates the number of people who actually believe these ideas is dependent on the claim. In that Cornell paper, the percent of respondents who both recalled seeing fake news and believed it ranged from 14 to 19%. This represents a higher percentage of the population actually believing fake news than we saw in 2016. One study published in the Journal of Economic Perspectives found that only 8% of Americans both recalled seeing and believing a piece of fake news about the 2016 election. So, on average, double the rate of people recalled and believed in fake news in the COVID context compared to what we saw in 2016, said Douglas Kreiner, a government professor at Cornell and one of the authors of the preprint. Many Americans are also having difficulty discerning accurate information. For example, in the Cornell paper, when shown headlines about treatments for COVID-19, 40% of respondents on average judged real headlines in this category to be true, and the remaining 60% were, quote, almost evenly divided between identifying the headline as false or acknowledging that they were unsure. If people are unable to discern and say what information is true, that is a real problem from a public health perspective, said Sarah Kreps, a government and law professor at Cornell and a co-author of the paper. In another preprint co-authored by Penny Cook, respondents were able to distinguish between accurate and false information about COVID-19 pretty well when prompted to. But when asked only whether they would share the information on social media and not if they believed it was true or not, more were willing to share fake news. They still only believe true content like 65-ish% of the time, and the false content they believe like 25% of the time. So not great, but at least there's a difference, Penny Cook said. If instead you ask them which ones would they share on social media, they're terrible at discerning between them. They don't, basically. One of the reasons we might be seeing more people falling for misinformation is the knowledge gap that comes from an emerging disease like COVID-19. There's a lot we still don't know about the virus, and that lack of understanding can create a vacuum that is all too easy to fill by conspiracy theories and misinformation. Studies have also found mixed results when it comes to issuing corrections on misinformation. One study on disinformation around Zika and yellow fever outbreaks in Brazil, published earlier this year in Science Advances and co-authored by Nyan, found that priming people with a fact sheet of accurate information had no significant impact on people's beliefs in subsequent false claims. One of Pennycook's papers suggests that merely prompting people to think about the fact that not everything online is true can be enough to reduce the amount of misinformation they share. But each of the researchers I spoke to expressed concern about people's ability to discern accurate information in a pandemic and what impact the deluge of bunk might have on making sure the truth gets communicated. The problem is we can't say how much fake news is reinforcing beliefs and entrenching beliefs and causing people almost to enter this domain of nihilism where they just throw up their hands. They don't know what to believe, so they're not going to believe anything. Not believing anything can be as pernicious as believing fake news. Okay, I want to end the show with a couple stories only peripherally related to the COVID-19, trying to reopen the show. This from the Nation's Health, from the American Public Health Association. CDC, vaccine for recent flu season cut visits to doctors by nearly half. Flu season was particularly hard on children, mostly because some were not vaccinated or only partially vaccinated, CDC says. Overall, during the 2019-2020 flu season, the vaccine reduced doctors' visits for flu illness by almost half, the study reported. Researchers said that the decline is important considering prevalence of the disease. In the last decade, researchers noted the flu resulted in upward of 21 million doctor visits, 810,000 hospitalizations, and 61,000 deaths each year. Vaccination remains the best way to protect against influenza and its potentially serious complications. CDC continues to recommend influenza vaccination while influenza viruses are circulating in the community. As of mid-March, CDC's FluView surveillance report for the 2019-2020 U.S. flu season estimated at least 36 million flu illnesses, 370,000 flu-related hospitalizations, and 22,000 deaths from flu. Among the deaths were 144 children, which is higher than every season since reporting began in 2004-2005, with the exception of the 2009 H1N1 pandemic. The recent flu season was especially hard for children. Most of the deaths among children occurred in those who were not vaccinated or were only partially vaccinated, the CDC study said. Work is already underway on developing next year's flu vaccine. The World Health Organization recommended that flu vaccines for the 2020-21 flu season in the Northern Hemisphere target influenza A strains H1N1 and H3N2, as well as two influenza B viruses. And lastly, from the Washington Post, U.S. roadways more lethal during the pandemic, safety group says. U.S. highways have been emptier during the coronavirus pandemic, but they've also been more deadly, according to statistics released Wednesday. The National Safety Council said preliminary data show that in March, when most Americans began to drive less because of pandemic-related stay-at-home orders, the fatality rate per mile driven went up by 14% compared to March 2019. The traffic fatality data compiled from all 50 states and the District of Columbia confirmed the alarming reports across the country that speeding and reckless driving during the health crisis are leading to a disproportionate number of crashes and fatalities. The surge in speeding and reckless behavior in the nation's roadways has alarmed police and road safety groups and prompted increased patrolling on some highways and renewed calls for drivers to slow down. As traffic volumes fell dramatically following the stay-at-home orders, average speeds increased significantly above posted limits, more than doubling in some cities, traffic data show. Well, I'm afraid this may relate to the people that are staying home, maybe have a propensity more toward safety than those venturing out. But another odd side effect of this epidemic. Well, that ends the show for today. If you'd like to review this show or queue up future shows, feel free to go to toppun.com, toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Or if you want to like or view the Facebook page for this show, go to facebook.com/justforhealthWAKT, where the 4 is the number 4, not written out, justforhealthWAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.